We have been working our way through the book of Acts, talking about what it means to have vibrant faith, to be a vibrant church, to be believers with vibrant faith. What does that look like? And in the beginning of Acts, the birth of the church really chronicles an amazing story of believers exploding onto the scene with vibrant faith. Luke, who wrote the Gospel of Luke and the book of Acts, was actually a disciple of the Apostle Paul. And when he wrote these two books, he actually wrote them really as one narrative to a Gentile friend named Theophilus. We don't know much about him, just that there was something special about this guy that Luke wrote this much. It's part of the reason why I love the Gospel of Luke and the book of Acts, because since he was writing to this Gentile, he would take time sometimes to explain Jewish words or Jewish customs. It kind of helps this room of Gentiles to sometimes understand things easier from Luke's perspective than maybe some of the other gospel and Bible writers. As we've been working our way through this, we've come today to Acts chapter 4. If you want to grab the pew Bible in front of you and flip there, we're going to be spending most of the time on a couple pages in the same vicinity. Turn to chapter 4, verses 32 through 37. Acts chapter 4, verse 32. All the believers were one in heart and mind. No one claimed that any of his possessions was his own, but they shared everything they had with great power. The apostles continued to testify to the resurrection of the Lord Jesus, and much grace was upon them all. There were no needy persons among them, for from time to time those who owned lands or houses sold them, brought the money from the sales, and put it at the apostles' feet, and it was distributed to anyone as he had need. Joseph, a Levite from Cyprus, whom the apostles called Barnabas, which means son of encouragement, sold the field he owned and brought the money and put it at the apostles' feet. This is a fascinating passage. And at first glance, we oftentimes think it's about giving, which it is. But there's actually two themes very strong in this passage. There's a church in incredible unity. Incredible unity together as a body of believers, and the giving that is reflected by that. Let's work our way through it a little more in detail. Verse 32, all the believers were one in heart and mind. Some translations translate it as one spirit. They were in one spirit or one soul. It talks about an incredible depth of friendship. These people knew each other. Right? John Wesley once put it, their loves, their hopes, their passions joined. Earlier in the chapter, in verse 24, we see them talking and praying in one voice. Now we see them living together in one spirit, supporting each other in one spirit, pursuing God together as one body. This is actually a reoccurring theme throughout Luke's writings, throughout the book of Luke, throughout the book of Acts, and then by other writers, New Testament writers, throughout the New Testament. One example is just a page or two previous in Acts chapter 2, verse 42. It's talking about the early church. They've just begun to explode onto the scene. And in 2 verse 42, it says, they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching, to the fellowship, to the breaking of bread, and to prayer. Everyone was filled with awe. Many wonders and miraculous signs were done by the apostles. All the believers were together and had everything in common, selling their possessions and goods. They gave to anyone as he had need. Every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes and ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favor of all people. And the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved. They were together. They had everything in common, selling their possessions and goods. The words there for sell and give, where they were selling their gifts and gifts and giving them to the church body. In the Greek, the technical term is that they were iterative imperfects. It means this was done again and again. This wasn't a one-time thing. This was a pattern for the early church. And this pattern, this lifestyle, this type of community was not a novel concept to the world 2,000 years ago. Jewish philosophers, Philo and Josephus, both wrote about this as an ideal not realized in culture generally, but an ideal to strive for. That the Greeks, Plato, Aristotle, and others also wrote about this as something that deep friends would do, this kind of sharing and supporting one another. The only community that we know of that actually practiced this outside of the church 2,000 years ago was the Qumran community. If you've ever heard of the Dead Sea Scrolls, it was a group of essentially Jewish monks who committed their lives to copying and preserving the scriptures. It's an incredible treasure for us today because we have copies of scriptures that prophesied what happened to Jesus that we can date to before his arrival, right? And so it gives us incredible support to the scriptures. But this community did live in that same way, where they all pooled their resources and shared together and lived together and supported each other so that no one was in need. But the difference was it was mandated. If you were going to be a part of the Qumran community, you did not have a choice. But with the early church, this wasn't a requirement. It was just something that happened, which is why, in many ways, this passage that we're looking at is much more about unity. These disciples, these apostles, just months before and years in the years previous under Christ, were constantly quarreling with each other, jockeying for position, looking to get ahead of one another. And now, suddenly, there is this level of unity between them. And this is spread to the rest of the church. United leadership is contagious to a body of believers. Let's flip back to chapter 4. Verse 32, all the believers were one in heart and mind. No one claimed that any of his possessions was his own, but they shared everything they had. With great power, the apostles continued to testify to the resurrection of the Lord Jesus, and much grace was upon them all. There were no needy persons among them. It's interesting that right in the middle of these verses, these sentences on giving, there's again a reminder about the mission, the evangelism, the reaching out to the world around them that was going on. It just saturates the book of Acts. That it wasn't just about a group of people being united together. They were united in mission. They weren't just committed to each other. They were committed to a mission God had given them. And when it says there were no needy persons among them, this was literal. They had what they needed because of the corporate giving. It's about unity. They thought of each other as family, as connected to one another. You know, I have four sons. As I look at my children as brothers with each other, my hope would be as a parent that they would be there to support each other, right? That as they grow older and they end up in different areas of life, different areas of status, that there would still be a love and unity among each other so that they wouldn't be in need because they love each other, because they're family. Right? And it's Luke is pointing out this is the same way with the body, that if there is a unity, if there is a love, if there is a commitment to each other, it has practical implications. In verse 34, it says, for from time to time, that literally, what it's communicating is this was a regular happening. It didn't happen at once. It wasn't, if you joined the New Testament church, you had to hand over the deeds to your property. That's not where we're going with this today. Don't worry. It was just over time, as needs arose, different ones were led to meet those needs. And this regularly happened. From time to time, those who owned lands or houses sold them, brought the money from the sales, and put it at the apostles' feet. And it was distributed to anyone as had need. Those who owned lands or houses, this was 2,000 years ago, only about 10% of the population would have been considered middle class, as either owning land or a house or both, right? Middle class was only 10% of the population. And then only about 4 to 7% of the population would have been considered wealthy, which means, if you do the math, I checked it several times, there's 80-something percent. I'm standing in front of a lot of people with calculators on their phones, right? Of the people that would have been considered poverty, that didn't own land, that didn't own homes. You know, perhaps they worked for someone and their home was part of that arrangement. Perhaps they rented somewhere. But this becomes a big deal because we talk about persecution. And persecution has begun to explode in the early church. We've talked in recent weeks about Stephen's martyrdom and that they're beginning to get arrested. They're beginning to feel enormous pressure. Well, there were financial ramifications to that as well. Good Jewish men and women that became Christians were finding themselves shunned from their families. They were finding themselves cut off from business opportunities. They were losing work. They were not getting hired. Right? And then added to that mix is there was an even greater separation between the classes than we would see today. Right? Because for those that grew up in the Jewish faith, being wealthy was considered a blessing from God. Being middle class was a blessing from God. That reflected that you had done something to earn favor in God's eyes, and this was your reward. And those that didn't have it had displeased God, right? And so you didn't see a mixing in that. They separate each other because why, if you're blessed with God, would you mix with those who aren't? It might rub off. But here we see this early church where believers of all different status were not only worshiping together and fellowshipping together, but they were sharing resources together. Those, this smaller group that were in the middle class and the upper class, were recognizing the need in these other believers that were losing everything because of their stand for faith and were stepping in and giving it to the church to meet those needs. There was this deep sense of family and commitment to one another. I was reading some of the statistics. The early church was facing incredible persecution, but that still goes on today. I read, according to Open Doors Ministry, that 322 Christians are killed each month for their faith. 214 churches and Christian-owned properties are destroyed each month. Numerous acts of violence are committed against Christians around the world every day. In addition to that, in many of these nations where they don't enjoy the same kind of religious freedom that we do today, there are those same financial ramifications. That there are believers living in desperate poverty. There are Christian parents wondering how they're going to be able to give their child their next meal. They're wondering how they're going to provide a home, right? There's so much going on around the world around us. And so this early church would lay these offerings at the apostles' feet, which really, that phrase and phrases similar to it throughout the Old Testament and New Testament paint a picture of submission. That they're just handing it over to the leadership to do as God, they're not dictating it to them. They're not controlling it. They're giving this offering to God to be used by the church to meet these needs. Then finally, he says, Joseph, a Levite from Cyprus, whom the apostles called Barnabas, which means son of encouragement, sold a field he owned and brought the money and put it at the apostles' feet. This actually serves two purposes, these two little verses here. One is he's giving an example. He's given the big picture. Look, this is what people are doing. Here is an example of someone who has done it, Barnabas. It also serves as an introduction to a man that we're going to hear more about later in Acts and throughout the New Testament as one of these leaders in the early church. Now, in chapter 5, he also tells a negative example of this going on, but that's getting ahead. We'll talk about that next week. I'm actually very excited about that passage. I have a lot of fun with it. But getting back to this, there is a part of me, maybe you're like me, that reads this and goes, that's just not realistic. That's easy 2,000 years ago, whatever. But in modern day America, that kind of community could not exist. And the reality is Luke isn't necessarily prescribing this is how it is to be for all Christians. And that's why I think the deeper issue is the unity issue and how that impacts the rest of our Christian faith. But a few years back, in 2010, we sent a team of students on a mission trip to Chicago with CSM. And one of the experiences they came back from, it was really shocking to me to hear about it when they came back, and I had to look it up to see, is this for real? They visited a church called Jesus People USA. I thought, well, how come you guys get to be the Jesus people? I thought we all were. But they visited this church, and it was a very unique church. What the church had done, it was a body of about 400 people or so. It formed several decades ago. They actually bought a 10-story building. It used to be owned by Al Capone. Talk about changing the purpose of a building. Right? And they bought this building, and the first floor became their church. The second through seventh floor became apartments for the body. There's about 400 of them that live there. There's also some other believers that are part of the church that live in the surrounding area. And then the top three floors, they turned into housing, either low income or free housing, for senior citizens, for elderly people that don't have the resources. Now, this body of believer actually does pool all of their resources. As they, for those of them that work outside of the building and the community around them, they take their salaries and they give it over to the church, right? And then there are those within the building that work to maintain the building, to maintain the church, to maintain the ministry that they have going on in the upper floors. And so there's this body that regardless of level of income, they all share together. I remember the students coming back going, yeah, man, McNutt, if they need a new pair of shoes, they check in with the leadership of the church. They check in with this or that. And I thought, wow, I don't know if I could do that. And yet, it's this incredible modern-day version of exactly what we're reading about in the book of Acts. Giving for the early church was not a new concept. Old Testament worship involved the tithe, the temple tributes, the temple tax. It actually ended up being more like a quarter of their income was given towards worship, but it was mandated. It was a rule. It was a requirement. You did this. There was no conversation about the heart behind it. It was, this is what you did, and you checked off the box, and you were a good follower of God. Christ turned the tables on that. When we look at the early church, it's no longer just about percentages or checking off, I've done this and now I'm good with God. It's about an attitude of worship. It's about being a part of the unity of the body. This focus on the mission, resources, money, these, instead of becoming things that we view of as mine, become viewed as tools to use for God's glory. Some look at the New Testament and go, see, there's nothing specifically mandating a tithe, that instead we see this principle over and over to give as we're able, and look at that as a way to say, see, I'm not required to, when really the attitude behind it seems to be, no, to give as we're able means to expand on that. That every example of giving in the New Testament is beyond the 10% that we normally think of and speak of. That this is an incredible act of worship, an expression of love to God. I never fully got what that meant, right? Growing up as a child, I grew up as a pastor's kid. Baptist church, so I heard about giving all the time. In fact, I remember vaguely, my parents like to tell this story a lot. There was one time for my birthday, I had gotten $20 when I was a little kid, and my dad said, well, you need to give $2 to the church, and apparently I got angry. I had a look on my face, and my dad goes, what's with the look? What's going on? And according to them, I said, how come I have to give $2 when you only give pennies and nickels? And my dad was like, what? But then he realized that every week he was handing me the change in his pocket to put in. I hadn't seen the check he was writing, right? I'm like, come on, Pastor Dan. So, but about 12 years ago, my oldest son, when he was two, or almost two, his favorite thing in the world were Skittles. Now, he was our first son. So we were really good about limiting candy to the, by the time we got to the fourth, we'd just given up. He's on a nonstop sugar buzz. He finds it throughout the house, wherever it is. Our other sons will complain, he's taking all my candy. And we're like, really? We told you you're not allowed to have candy in your room. So how did that happen? It's an awkward silence, right? But 12 years ago, my, you know, almost 2 years old, he loved Skittles. He would rarely get them. And I had a big bag of Skittles. It was a bag of the fun size packages. You know, they call them fun size. There's 12 Skittles in them. There's nothing fun about that. The fun size is the 3-pound bag. So I had these, and every once in a while I'd give him one. And normally, you know, he's at that age. What's the epitome of selfishness, right? Like a 2-year-old. The word they use the most, mine. And so I'm like, you want some Skittles? And he's like, we go in, and I take out, and I get the little fun size, and I rip it open, and I hand it to him, and he's so excited. He's like bouncing up and down. And the first thing he does is he dumps some out in his hand, and he hands them back to me to share, right? Yeah, some of you just, that's what I did. I was like, oh, my word. And I'm standing there thinking, this is ridiculous. Like, he literally just saw I'm the source of the Skittles for him, right? Like, I've got an entire bag up there, but his first thought, he was so excited to hit this thing. For him, that was a thing of great value, tremendous worth, and his first thought was to give some back to me. Why? Because he loved me. I'm his dad. Right, and he wanted to share this good thing with this person that he loved. And that was the moment I clicked. I went, that's why giving is worship. Right, because when we sacrifice something of great value to us, that gift carries weight. That gift carries meaning. Right, and we know, if there's one thing as people that we react to and get our emotions to, it's money, it's finances. Yeah, we can Many debates will stay friendly until the politician puts our wallet in danger, and then there are some impassioned Americans. Right? Well, we react. Why? Because it's important to us. And so when the scriptures talk about giving being an act of worship, an act of love, that's why giving out of a joyful heart it has that same impact to our Heavenly Father that my son handing me a few of his precious Skittles did 12 years ago. It is to be worship. Luke chapter 18. There's this incredible story of a rich ruler coming to Jesus and asking how he would get into heaven. And he kind of lays out all of the ways that he's done the right thing. He's followed the commandments. He's served in the right way. He's honored his parents. He's done all of these things. And Jesus looks at him in verse 22 of chapter 18. Jesus said to him, "You still lack one thing. Sell everything you have and give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven. Then come follow me." When he heard this, he became very sad because he was very wealthy. Was he unable to follow Christ because he was wealthy? No, the Bible is full of wealthy followers of God, right? Throughout the Old Testament and even into the New Testament. And yet for this particular man, Christ singled out this issue. So it wasn't about that we have to lose everything to be able to follow God. What Christ recognized in this man's heart was that his love for his wealth was such that if he were forced to choose between following God and having his wealth, he was sad because there was no choice to him. He was going to keep the wealth. It gets back to the worship that we are to have God as our first love, and nothing can come in the way of that. And that as followers of God, we are to view the church body, not just here, but globally, as our brothers and sisters, our family, that there is to be this unity in faith and mission that has concrete, practical ramifications. Darrell Bach, a theologian that writes a lot about the book of Acts, wrote, "Community life means both mission and mutual care. These occur because people care about one another and the cause they share. They see their obligation to God, even their worship, to be reflected in respect for other believers. What 1 John 2 calls a love for the brethren, unity does not come naturally, because we often like to go our own way. But to those who share the goal of reflecting the unity and reconciliation that Jesus brings, there is a desire to be sure that his body, the church, reflects his goals through concrete means." They were united. They had a mission. Are we? Do we have that mission? This affected everything for them, how they interacted with each other, how they viewed their possessions, their wealth, their resources, how they prayed, how they worshiped. Sometimes we think of worshiping as just the singing portion of the service, but worshiping is giving glory and honor to God. And so for them, this impacted how they worshiped with their voices, how they worshiped with their fellowship, how they worshiped through their pursuit of discipleship, how they worshiped in their service, how they worshiped in their evangelism, and how they worshiped through their giving. The question for us then is, does our faith impact every area of our lives? What is your first love? Is it God? Do you care for his church? If you, like the rich ruler, were approached by Christ, what would he tell you is in the way of you pursuing God with your whole heart? What would he tell you is keeping yourself from what would he tell you is keeping you from giving yourself fully to God? Would Christ tell you to sell everything and give to the poor? Is that where that is in your life? See, for the believer, if our possessions are seen as anything as other than belonging to God, that we are stewards of the resources that he has given us, there is a problem. What do we need to put him first? You know, maybe practically speaking, it means starting somewhere. I've, in many different spiritual disciplines, I like to challenge people to set reasonable goals. I had a Bible school professor who used to tell us his quiet time, his prayer time was 4 hours every day. He would get up at 4 a.m. and he would tell us we needed to do that. And I would sit there and go, well, I can't have a quiet time. I do not have the attention or focus to do that. Right? And then I remember being challenged years later by someone else going, no, the goal is to make it a habit, to be regular. And so if to become practice, to make this a regular habit, to make this a regular discipline means praying for 5 minutes a day, then start there and build from there, because the point is making it a practice. Not knocking a home run one time and then never being able to do it again because you overwhelmed yourself too much. I think the same could apply to what we're talking about today when we talk about giving. If giving is an area that God is challenging you to do, don't look to the most generous giver around you and think, I need to emulate that. Start where God is leading you in a regular pattern and build from there as he continues to bless and guide you and lead you.